So, research by the Corporate Leadership Council. That sounds like a fun crew, doesn't it?
Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Christopher Such.
Hello again.
And Stephen Lockyer.
Hello.
And Stephen, this is your first time with us.
It is.
I thought it'd be really good to find out a bit about who you are, where you're from, just to get us started.
Okay, I'm 25th year of teaching this year. I've worked in a variety of schools and settings, in a variety of locations in Kent, East Sussex, and now I'm in Surrey, just outer London, working in year six. I've taught from year one up to year eight. I've asked every year to teach in reception. Not yet, but soon it will happen, I'm sure. I keep pestering them. And I've had a variety of roles. I'm very liminal in my experience, so I've been everything up to a deputy head and back down again. And I think one of my appraisals about 6 or 7 years ago, I said that I think I'd be a really good head in the 80s and 90s when you could spend a lot of time in front of children rather than in front of an Excel spreadsheet or filling in CPOMs constantly. And I think I'm very front facing and I like being creative, and I love teaching. I still love teaching. Like at heart, being with a class, seeing those moments occur live is just, it's like a thrill. It's a complete thrill. So, yeah, still love teaching. It's very rare to hear someone say that after 25 years as well, isn't it? There's a group on Facebook called Thrive and Survive, and it's basically, I'm a teacher, get me out of here. And apparently a fifth of teachers in the UK belong to that group. So, I mean, I know that Teacher Tap does surveys to find out when people are thinking of leaving teaching, but if a fifth of teachers are currently looking at an exit, then there's something that we've got wrong that we know we have been exploring, obviously, the past couple of years. But I'm still banging the drum for the magic in the classroom. I think it's brilliant, and if we can capture more of those moments and get rid of the moments that teachers come to dread and push them over the edge and push them away from teaching, then albeit. And I think it's remarkably simple, really, because you've got a profession who happily spend sometimes thousands of pounds every year going to conferences, buying things for their class, spend hours in front of the TV at night laminating stuff for their class the next day. Loads of goodwill is spent, thousands of pounds worth of goodwill is spent. So it's not about workload, it's the right workload, isn't it? And it's the things that I think the reason people spend all that time doing those extra things is because they know it makes a difference. And I think if the workload was everything you do will make a difference, then you've got it made, haven't you? And I think that some teachers, well, a lot of teachers are feeling like, I'm not sure that this is actually making the difference that I need it to make. And that's when you feel you're doing a job rather than a career or a passion or a calling almost. And I think that you can call it a calling. You know, I think that there are teachers who walk around a supermarket and see some strange gadget and go, that'd be useful in a maths lesson in some distant dream. I mean, Poundland is like catnip for teachers, isn't it? You look at these things and go, everyone else would go, what a pile of junk. And you're thinking, if I get six of these, that'd be perfect for a small group activity. And that's the, there's still going to be people growing up like that. And I think that we can attract those. And if we can get some of those really good teachers back who were driven away by the workload and just change the workload just slightly, I think it'll make a significant difference. Anyway, that was my rant. I think we're supposed to be talking about books. I apologise. But that, yeah, there we go. You asked me one question and I've ranted on. Apologies.
Oh, a couple of things jumped into my mind when you were, I mean, I don't think it was a rant. I thought it was perfect. It was remarkably coherent given the nature of the subject matter. Immediately the word that Sam Sims used, like the idea of fluff load, that it isn't workload really that bothers teachers. It's what he calls fluff load.
Yeah.
It's stuff that is work but isn't contributing to the profession. I do think, you know, having a word for that that maybe the kind of the profession can agree upon over time can help us to start better isolating that thing. You know, the first step to, you know, making a difference is to somehow, you know, to actually label it in the first place and say, like, this stuff is the problem. Also, it reminds me of, I've recently been reading a book that hasn't been published yet by Nathaniel Hansford, The Scientific Principles of Teaching, a book that he's kind of republishing, but he originally self-published and now a publisher is going to kind of put it out there. And he's taught in, I think, Canada, Korea, the UK, and one other country. And one of the things he said was that it's basically a 40-hour week job in every country he's worked in, except for the UK, mm-hmm. where he said it was 55 to 60 hours a week and I didn't think I could be a teacher. But in every other country he's taught in, he's like, yeah, this works. This is quite a nice profession. I can see myself doing this for the foreseeable, which suggests that firstly, we're getting things wrong somewhat, but also that, you know, maybe the solution is there if we just seek it.
I think there's a similar phrase to Fluffload that I've heard, which is called the inshittification of things. And I think sometimes we're going, what do they want? What do DfE want? Maybe they want this, and maybe they want this as well. So we're going to do both of these things in the hope that one of these things will stick. And it's like, if we are strong and true to our values, if it's as simple as we want the children to leave this school content, successful, and able to think for themselves, if every single decision we're going is, will this actually make a significant difference? Or does it matter what colour the slip of paper that we're having to stick into the book is? I mean, it doesn't actually matter, does it? The colour that we mark doesn't matter. If we're helping the children to be successful and feel successful and think for themselves, then everything else, it is fluff, isn't it? Yeah. I think going back to those cores are really, really important. And I think that there's it's very interesting comparing different educational settings. And I think we have got this mentality of we'll do the hours. And I think we'll do the hours for the right thing. Like there are some people who spend weekends standing outside by wet football matches, volunteering to support things. And I think teachers have got the same thing of, we'll do it if we can see the benefit. And I think if we can either convince people of the benefit or get rid of the rubbish so that there is everything we're doing is beneficial. Like, case in point, I'm really rubbish at display. I've got really, really lofty ideas of what display should look like. In reality, hopeless at it. And so everything that I have to do towards display is absolutely painful. Breaks my heart. When someone says we need to change the display, I'm thinking instantly of any other thing. Like, I would rather I'd rather write reports than do display, because I know at least that if I'm thinking about those children when I'm writing those reports, it's going to make the way that I teach them slightly different. Whereas, and I'm sure, Chris, you'll show me something that tells me that displays actually benefit the children, but I haven't found it yet. In fact, you know what? I think a nice table and a good meal is probably more effective for a children and a conversation than a big display. Turns out that my house doesn't have any displays, and yet we can still learn. It's a weird argument, I know, but yeah.
I actually read a paper the other day where they tested the distraction level of displays with a group of people who had special educational needs and a group of people who didn't, so to speak. And the people with sort of moderate to severe difficulties got more distracted by the displays than all the other pupils. And so the argument these guys made, and I don't know how robust the study was, but they were saying essentially that it had a detrimental effect on these kids who really didn't need to be distracted, or, you know, could benefit from not being distracted by stuff.
I mean, how can we have a staff meeting that starts with talking about reducing cognitive load and ends with, and don't forget to change those displays and make sure those working walls are working? I had a criticism once after an observation, and they said, just don't know what's going on with that display, whether it's coming up or going down. Well, it's a working wall. You tell me exactly what that should be doing, because it's not working for me.
It is great to hear that you do still love teaching. I mean, certainly whenever I got close to that precipice of headship, I saw the bureaucracy. And I decided it wasn't for me. So I can totally see where you're coming from. And I think one day I'll just try and find a job. And Chris, you talked about this before. Just try and teach the maths in a school. So I just get to walk around primary school teaching all the maths, you know, from, like you said, from reception to six. If such a job exists, because it really is the best bit of it. And like you absolutely say, it's the reason you become a teacher in the first place. It certainly isn't to do spreadsheets and to, you know, six assessments six times a year.
I mean, I put on Twitter a few weeks ago that I'd only ever seen one of the teachers I'd ever worked for teach. And loads of people contributed to that and said, oh, I've only seen my head teacher teach once. Or and then there was a small but vocal minority of heads who said, I still teach. Don't say that I'm not a head teacher because I don't teach, because I do. Like, I wasn't attacking you, but like, your title is head teacher. So do you not think that you're probably best placed, given your title, to be a really good role model? Don't you think it'd be brilliant if you got to see your head teacher teach? Because this may come across as incredibly shallow, but I think that my respect professionally for a head teacher, if I saw them teach and thought, you know, they really do know their onions, my value in what they would tell me to how to teach would leap incrementally. Absolutely. By respect of that, I've got four children, three of whom I really like, and they tell me that their head teacher sometimes teaches them, and they come back with like the most appalling pedagogy. And as a result, I'm thinking, I don't really rate the school as much now, because if that's what the head teacher thinks is a successful lesson, then I'm really worried. And you know, I think what a role model. I think that the heads are very, very hard pressed in terms of time. They're always given lots of problems. People come through the door just saying, deal with this, deal with this, deal with this. And they pay an awful lot of attention to the parents doing the doors at the start and the end of the day, and an awful lot of response to emails. But I think sometimes just letting the teachers see them teach would be a really exciting, for me, really exciting event. Like, what an amazing staff meeting if they said, actually, the staff meeting is going to be between 2 and 3, and I'm taking year five, and I want you to come and watch. And like, what a pressure on them. Maybe similar impression to when you've got four teachers or four people observing you. I think it's quite an interesting concept.
In there, you mentioned the things that we do in education just because they're education. And the focus of this episode is going to be perhaps things we can learn or ways that we can learn from professions, fields outside of our own almost edu bubble. So I think at this point it makes sense to say, Stephen, what you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
I should start by saying I'm quite a passionate reader. I will read almost anything. I can remember distinctly getting frustrated with cereal boxes not having enough writing on them, because when you're having cereal in the morning, for those of you who don't know me, I look incredibly young, but I'm actually quite old now. And I was brought up at a time without devices. And so your entertainment was either cartoons of a morning or reading the cereal box whilst you're eating your cereal. And I remember being frustrated that there wasn't enough writing on the cereal box. And then I had this idea of a cereal box that had a series of episodes. So you'd like wait for the next episode to come out on the Frosties or whatever other cereals available. So yeah, I'll read whenever I can. I'll always have a book by my bed, in my bag, in the car. That's because that's always useful. The amount of times I'm hovering outside waiting for a club to end. And so I probably read between 50 and 60 books a year. My record was 107, but I would say that that became obsessive and not particularly enjoyable. So I would say 1 a week is doable, 2 a week is doable, but less pleasurable. But I think that setting yourself a target and reading widely. So I tend to go fiction, non-fiction, fiction, non-fiction. And I particularly like the section in Waterstones they call smart thinking, which is essentially self-help with stories of Jeff Bezos. So there's lots of popular psychology in there, lots of books that you thought this, but actually it's this. Simon Sinek style books, and I really like those. The tricky thing about those is that they tend to use the same group of studies. So I think after a while, you tend to hear the same things. The second challenge with them is that up until about 3 years ago, Elon Musk was a god in their eyes. And so every time I read a story about how wonderful Elon Musk is, it sort of jars with me now that we've seen that he's a complete nincompoop. And the third one is that sometimes these books could be summed up in a leaflet, and there's an awful lot of padding. See also Simon Sinek. So you get the first chapter, and it's really good, and you think, okay, what's next? And you discover that what's next is nine more chapters exemplifying that. So a really good smart thinking book is sometimes hard to come by. But I've got two or three books that I'd like to share with you this evening, if that's okay. The first one is called Steal Like an Artist. And this is by he's an artist called Austin Kleon, actually, and he started off doing by doing blackout poetry. So finding a leaflet, finding a news article, and then selecting words from that and blacking out everything else. And he wrote this book called Steal Like an Artist. Now, I should also confess that I read everything on a Kindle. Don't get me wrong, my house is surrounded with books, but in terms of convenience, like I've got 300 books in that tiny little device. I've got the Paperwhite, and it's brilliant. Like I do genuinely love it. And it also means because I can flit quite a bit. So if I do get a little bit bored, I can quite easily jump into some fiction to escape. But Steal Like an Artist is a really clever short book. It takes maybe under an hour to read, and it's got some great quotes. On a Kindle, if you don't have one, you can basically select a word, phrase, paragraph, section, and then save it straight away as a quote. And then at the end, you can look through. So here are three quotes from this book that I really liked. And I'll explain why I liked them. This is about influence and about the fact that we can be influenced, but it's better to be influenced and then become original. And this is Gary Panter. So Gary Panter, it doesn't say who he was, but Gary Panter said, if you have one person you're influenced by, everyone will say you're the next whoever. But you rip off 100 people, everyone will say you're so original. And that's absolutely true. And I think as teachers, we can, especially with teaching practice, when you're learning to be a teacher, you're stuck with a teacher who has a certain style, and they tend to put you with quite an experienced teacher who has found their style, found their groove. And they found their groove and they found what works for them. And I don't know if you guys have experienced this before, but when you sometimes you have a student and they what they'll do is they'll go, I've got all the theory behind this, but what I'm going to try and do is emulate you, and pick up what you do and the style that you do things and the energy that you bring different things. And I think that we're there as a model, but what you should do is cherry pick and look at your strengths as a trainee, because if you're trying to emulate someone, the children are going to see that you're putting on an act, and you have to find your own groove, as it were. And I think that trainee teachers have it very tough because there's lots and lots of marker points that they have to hit, lots of things that they have to do, and yet it's probably the best chance that they're ever going to get to play and find their style, find their groove. And it is teaching is something you have to find your style in. And I think that we don't want the whole of teachers. We want individual characters, because I think that if you had all the same teachers in a school, it'd be a very, very undynamic school. The fact that a school works is because you'll have some people who are wildly enthusiastic about the play and not so much about the sport, and someone else who's wildly enthusiastic about the sport, but not so much that. Some people who are really confident to do assemblies, other people who aren't, but are brilliant one-to-one. And I think that teaching practice certainly is a chance for you to go, I really like that, I really like that, I really like that. And I think that one of the most powerful things for an ECT teacher is to look at their, to give themselves an honest appraisal of their strengths and weaknesses and go, here are my weaknesses, here's mine, display. What's the best thing I can do as someone who wants to improve display? Not a course, but go and find the person in my school who's really good at display and go, how do you do it? Tell me what your method is. Because they're going to be the people, because they love it, they've worked out all the shortcuts. So I think that lots of training pushes us out, but I think good training pushes us in and goes, look, we're if you're in a two form entry school, you've got 13 experts and you that you can draw on, and everyone is really, really good at something. If they weren't, they wouldn't be there anymore because they'd have given up. So these people who've still got the passion alive. So draw on those experts and take cherry pick the best of that person and the best assessment of that person. The person who never seems to do any marking, clearly they're doing marking. Yeah. So how are they doing it? What's their strategy? I saw someone mark standing up. And I said, don't you get tired? And they said, no, marking standing up takes half the time because otherwise you get tired. It's like, that's actually genius, isn't it? So now I mark standing up because it takes less time because you just get tired. And it tends to keep your energy levels going. So I think that's a really, really clever quote. I don't know, again, who Gary Panter is, but he was wise. And the second one is, this is really nice. So this is a really nice quote about creativity. Creativity isn't just the things we choose to put in, it's the things we choose to leave out. And I think that a lot of people think that the curriculum is restrictive because it's not creative. And I think that defies logic because there's so much that the beauty of teaching is that you can be creative. And if you're in a school where you can't be creative, change schools, because like this is the one thing that we've really, really got. The thing that we can be really strong about is our creativity and bring our own passions to the fore. Now, I've been teaching the suffragettes with my class recently, and hand on heart, I knew very little about it. I've never taught it before, never ever taught it before, so I didn't know anything about the suffragettes at all, past sort of pub knowledge. I mean, Pankhurst, that's it. And so I've been learning so much about it. And it's so exciting for me to go, this is something completely new for me. And just sharing that joy of something being new for me is helping my children thrive in it as well, because they're along for the ride. And I think that showing that creativity and the excitement that you have for something is just as important to show the children rather than the whole doing stuff, right? We're going to do phonics now. Like that sounds more like a punishment, doesn't it? Whereas if you say, guys, I've been reading about this, and I cannot get over how interesting it is. Let me share with you, bring them along for the adventure. And I think that if we've got one thing in our arsenal as teachers, we are creative. And if we're not allowed to be creative in our own curriculum, in our own lessons, then we might as well work at a supermarket because that's part of the charm of the job, surely. That and holidays.
I mean, immediately the first thing that jumps out to me when you say creativity is what we leave out. It reminds me about when people talk about jazz and they say like you've got to listen for the notes that aren't there. But I know exactly what you mean. I mean, especially true with writing. The nature of trying to put something together. It's as much about not the process of writing is as much about cutting as it is about putting something down on the page. And there is. I'm reading a bit of writing the other day by Sarah Cottinghat, and it's wonderful. But I got to read like the before version and the after version, and I saw as much of her personality from what she had removed as from what was in there. So that idea of creativity is what is in part what we remove as much as what we put in place. Yeah, that resonated with me certainly.
On your initial quotes, I reckon, if I'm honest with myself, I was probably somewhere between 5 and 10 years in the classroom before I was comfortable in my own skin, if that makes sense. Because like I've seen lots of students try and emulate their mentors or their, the principal teachers responsible for their sort of development. And I remember trying to imitate my NQT mentor, but I'm reasonably introverted, and so trying to mimic extroverts, you just end up doing a half-baked job. And so I can totally see that. And it's almost like a rite of passage, because as a new teacher, you think they want you, okay, let's they want me to be like them.
Do me, but younger. And that, like a good mentor will just say, do you. And I think that I would imagine that you can be as captivating as an introverted, quiet teacher, as someone who's exuberant and game showy. Because I know what my style is quite game showy, and I'm like the Tigger. But I am able to do those soft spots rather like I'm sure you're quite a quiet teacher, but you're able to do those peaks when you need to as well. And it's reading the class that's as important as writing to the class, if you like. And the emulation thing is really, I think you're right. It probably is a rite of passage. I'll do you. That hasn't worked out. I now need to find my own style. And the sooner trainee teachers get permission to find your own style, the better it is, I think. But you're right. How long did you think it took for you to discover your style, Chris?
A lot longer than it probably should have done. In terms of, you know, the time I spent in the classroom was basically 2008 to 2021. So 13 years, I would say the vast majority of that I was only ever trying to do whatever version of teaching I thought the head teacher or deputy head, whoever was kind of most I felt was in charge, what they wanted to see. I was trying to do a good version of that. And I think I learned a lot by doing lots of different things. Mm-hmm. But it means that the majority of my teaching career, I wasn't particularly reflective. I wouldn't say that I ever really developed my own style, as it were, until much later. I think others looking at what I was doing would have argued otherwise. But in terms of the nuts and bolts of how I was structuring lessons, I wasn't really doing my own thing for the vast majority of my teaching career, I'd say.
That's really honest, isn't it, Kieran? I think that's quite an honest thing to say. And I think that, I mean, we do end up, is it sort of, the tail wagging the dog, like this is what you want to see, this is what you will see instead. I had a moment last week when I was teaching my class and everything about it probably on paper was wrong, because I was sitting in the middle of the children with half of them, I was facing side on. So I was facing out the windows, looking through the rows, if you like, with half the children behind me. And I'd sat down with a child who wouldn't normally have contributed an awful lot to the class, but he'd written brilliant opening paragraph for a balanced argument. And we have this joke in the class that if I read a children's piece of work, I'll go, I won't do your voice. And then I go, once upon a time. And I always do like a mock voice. And then I did that and the class laughed. So correct. Well done, children. And then I read his paragraph. I said, that's such a fantastic paragraph. Really, really good. And I gave it an awful lot of praise, picked up on a little bit that he needed to change. And then a voice behind me said, I agree. And it was my head who'd been standing there for who knows how long, but apparently long enough to hear me do an impression of him. And everything about that was wrong. But I think that that was the most genuine moment that they could have seen. Like, the unobserved observation is sort of fantastic. And I think that as teachers, I think we fall into basically two camps. I'm being observed. I'm going to have a breakdown. Watch me have a breakdown. Watch all the tech fail. Watch me fluff my words, miss out huge things, forget children's names, disaster zone. And then you've got, I'm going to be observed. Here it comes, all singing, all dancing. And I think that the third way is either some sort of the tech Iris Connect, where you're watching, but not, you don't know if you're being watched or not, or that thing, that unobserved observation. Like, the best people to give observation feedback are the TAs, aren't they? Because they're in there the whole time, you know, rain or shine, they see flaws and all, don't they? And if it was a permissive enough relationship where they could give you honest feedback and you weren't too precious about taking it badly, if it was developmental, they'd be the most amazing people for giving feedback. A phenomenal sort of top, bottom up approach, if you like.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth in that idea about observation. I think often the way that observations have been structured, or at least the way they were structured in the past, have slowed down some of that process of people finding their groove, finding that sense of confidence in what they're doing. I mean, just to briefly go back to, you know, where I started to feel comfortable. Weirdly enough, it was when our school was growing in size and we didn't have enough classrooms, and we ended up converting the library, which wasn't its own classroom. It was a glorified corridor, into a classroom. And for the first year, I didn't have any walls. So I effectively had an open classroom where if teachers needed to go from one side of the school to work to the other, if the head teacher needed to go from one side of the school to the other, I basically had kids, head teachers, governors, whoever it was, walking through my classroom constantly. I had absolutely zero privacy. And there were issues with that, with regards to, you know, telling stories and this sort of thing. But in the end, it meant that by the end of that year, I had been subtly observed without me realizing it, because they're coming down the corridor where I can't see them yet. Yeah, I'd been certainly observed hundreds and hundreds of times. Yeah. And at the end of that period, the head teacher still, you know, wanted me to work at the school, still thought I was worth it, was still worth employing. And so from then I thought, oh, okay, there's nothing to fear, really. So I think in some ways it's tempting to think, well, I'll build up my confidence if I close the door and I've got time in my own little cocoon. And yet I think on some level, actually just having your door open, being kind of subtly observed all the time does help you to realize that it isn't that scary.
Is it leveraged leadership? The one that that model is that the head teacher will go and see 5 or 10 minutes every single week of every single teacher. And you know, 3-4 entry, what is that? That's 3 hours out of a 40-hour or 25, 3 hours out of 25 school hours in a week. I think that's amazing in terms of professional development, especially if they're focusing on one thing. Like if they treated walkthroughs as this week we're just going to, I'm going to pop in for 10 minutes, see some questioning, see how you handle some questions. This is what we're covering. And that incremental observation, I think, does both, doesn't it? It allows the head teacher to get an absolute taster of every single class and every single teacher in a very, very low stakes, you know, 10 minutes. So you're not really going to worry about 10 minutes, are you? I don't think, especially if you don't know when it's going to happen, or even if you do know it's going to happen, because it's just 10 minutes. And at the same time, like you were saying, Chris, you just get used to someone being in there the whole time. I'm sure your lessons would improve because you relax more, because it's not a dramatic thing that's happening in the timetable. It just happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things that also made that so beneficial with hindsight was the fact that it meant that the head teacher or whoever saw me teaching lots and lots and lots, and occasionally they'd say, oh, I like this, or I like that, or, oh, by the way, I'm not sure if you've noticed, but, you know, this kid at the back of the class has secretly got something in their pencil case. You might want to keep an eye on that. So I'm getting all sorts of little bits of feedback.
Yeah.
But a lot of the time I'm being observed and not getting any feedback. A lot of the time I'm just being seen. Yeah. And so that it means that when I do get a bit of feedback, it's on a bit of teaching where I haven't been putting on a show, because I'm not expecting to get feedback. I'm just carrying on with my teaching. And so it means that they get a real sense of what I'm like on a day-by-day basis. And I get used to the idea of being watched without necessarily expecting feedback. So you stop performing. And I think
it's a higher level of authenticity, isn't it?
Yeah. Getting out of that, I think that's one of the hardest things, getting out of the performance mode.
Thank you. Well, my second book is one called Rebel Talent, Why It Pays to Break the Rules at Work. And it's by a writer called Francesco Gina. And there's some great quotes in this. And it's basically about not breaking the rules as in speeding, but going, why do we have to think about things this way? Is there an alternative way of looking at it? This is one of those ones where I kept on reading a research paper after research paper that she references that I've never heard before. So she constantly is drawing on things that I've not read before. And that's really exciting, because we can end up in this silo where we do read the same stories and refer to the same papers all the time. And I think that reading books that are outside the educational sphere can sometimes allow us to be exposed to ideas and concepts that maybe aren't directly relevant to education, but you can certainly place into education. So I just got, and what's brilliant about the Kindle, when you make a note, is that you have to write a note with your quote. So you have to put something. And some of my notes here are yes, yes, yes. So I obviously got very excited. This is when, in a real book, I'd have highlighted it and underlined it several times. So this is about asking for advice. So she did some research, and the author did a lot of this research. So good on her for promoting her own papers, to be honest. And this is the result of some of the research she did. Contrary to what we believe, asking for advice increases rather than decreases how competent we are perceived to be. We underestimate how flattering it is to be asked for advice. Now, I think that is super pertinent, especially for people of our age in teaching. And I think that there are definitely ages in teaching, because I think we've all said, like, it's taken us 5 to 10 years to find our own groove, as it were. So we've gone through toddler and childhood and then found our thing, and then you discover, I found my groove, but I still want to improve, and there's so much still that I don't know about this whole job that we're doing. And yet now I've been teaching for 10 years and probably I've got some positions of responsibility, and it's kind of embarrassing to ask for help. I'll say it again. We underestimate how flattering it is to be asked for advice. Now, going to see other teachers who have been teaching less than years than us, and even learning things from our student teachers, seeing things that they do and actually asking how they did that and taking advice from others is so important. And yet, I think sometimes as a profession, we're a bit nervous to actually vocalise that because we should know by now. We should be knowledgeable. We should be experts. I think that's a really risky position to be in. I mean, it's that whole thing about that tired trope about men not being willing to ask for help if they're lost. And they were refused to do that. And men not wanting for help carrying in all the supermarket shopping. They have to do it in one trip and whatever. And asking for help is so significant. And I'm just interested in you guys, the last time you actually asked someone genuinely for advice or help on something.
Well, that's a good question. Well, I also ask my partner for help all the time. I guess quite often I end up asking Kieran and, you know, Neil, lots of people who are involved in the podcast, you know, like informally, even if it's just things like, how did you deal with this? Where did you find that? Why do you think that again? And, you know, I generally don't have the humility immediately in the moment to say, oh, wow, I didn't think of it like that. Generally, I say, oh, yeah, that was what I was thinking.
Yeah. Then,
down the line, I'll come back and, you know, pretend it was my idea to begin with. I think quite possibly I fall into that area. I think it's natural to fall into that difficulty, as you say, the more you feel expert in an area.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to be perceived as, you want to be perceived as still learning, but you don't want anyone to actually see the process of you still learning.
Yeah. I think it's that fear of incompetence, isn't it? He's asking me for advice. He should know this, surely.
Yeah, like Chris says, I'll typically message other teachers a lot more easily than I'll message other mathematicians.
Right.
So for instance, if I can't do some maths, and I could very easily ask Stuart, who is a secondary teacher, specialist, expert, I'm thinking, no, I'm going to go and spend half an hour researching this bit of maths that I don't know rather than ask for help. So, but with education, it's a bit easier. Like I'll say to Chris, you know, okay, these are the pieces I put together.
Help.
Am I missing something?
Help.
what have I missed? And then Chris will typically come back to me, or Shannon, Neil, etc. Will give me the bits that I've forgotten about, or the bits that I haven't encountered yet. Yeah, but definitely with the maths, I would rather spend an hour relearning something or learn something for the first time than asking for help.
This is another quote, and this was about the way that Google defined the sort of people that they wanted to employ. And I thought this was really, really nice definition. Google was looking for people who are geeky enough to be annoyed at the very existence of a maths problem that they haven't solved and smart enough to rectify the situation. Now, I think that when you're applying for jobs, you have to put that first paragraph is your philosophy for teaching. And I really like that idea of that itch. That itch that you can't scratch. And so I love the moments when you've got the class on board with that desire for an itch. Case in point, went to a class assembly the other week, and the class, maybe year two, year three, was talking about the solar system. And they did a song about the solar system, and they said that the nearest planet to the sun was only the second hottest. And this was just in a song, right? And as we're walking back, one of the children in my class said to me, why is the one that's nearest the sun second hottest? And I was like, that's it. That's the itch. And I think that in terms of a philosophy for education, what you want children to have, but from my perspective, certainly, is that itch to want to know more. And we as teachers, I mean, it's really exciting teaching. But that real buzz for me certainly comes when they come the next day and they go, I made this, I researched this, I read up on this, I've made some notes. And you think, good, because that lesson has continued beyond 3 p.m. for that child, and it's been buzzing around that itch. There's the other philosophy, and I don't know who said this one, about education being knowing what to do when you don't know what to do. And I really like that concept of, I'm not sure how to complete this, but I know ways that I can try and solve it. And that again is that itch. And I think the curiosity is much maligned, maybe undervalued, because it's not seen as a very, there's not a clinical answer for lots of curiosity other than go and find out. But we did, as a class, my classes can be quite tangential sometimes. We did explore that immediately because quite a few of us in the class had that itch of why is the planet nearest the sun only the second hottest? Doesn't make any sense. Do you know, guys? Just a pop quiz.
It's an atmospheric thing, isn't it?
It's
Yeah,
an
kind of,
atmospheric thing, you see.
Venus has the equivalent of a, greenhouse gases that will heat it up, whereas Mercury doesn't, so.
Chris is available for all pub quizzes in the local area. Yeah. So this is something that sang out to me from this same book. And this is just a throwaway line that I thought was so true about appraisals. It's a curious reality that most large organizations manage their employees based on weakness. And I think that that's a really interesting perspective. And she goes on to state that if you build on the strengths, if you start in an appraisal with the strengths that someone has and purely focus on those, then those members of staff outperformed by everyone else by like something 26, 27%. So you don't even mention the weaknesses. You say, you're really strong at that. How can we build that? And that's a really interesting perspective. I know that I left one job after an appraisal that I had where I thought, I had this same appraisal 3 years ago. Like nothing, literally nothing has changed. I've turned into staff furniture. And it's brilliant that you can wheel me out and teach a class, but I feel like I'm stagnating. I think that appraisals are quite a tricky thing. I think they're very, I think again, I think they're very, very strange because they're so unusually structured in schools. I think for the vast majority of teachers, it is something that we decided, a set of targets we decided with some school targets in October. And then you'll get an email probably April saying we need to have the midterm appraisal, and you'll hurriedly look up and see what your targets are, and then backwards find some evidence to show that you've been meeting those targets. And then in October, you'll hurriedly find some more evidence to prove that your targets were met using data that had been perhaps encouraged by members of SLT to meet targets that they were themselves asked to meet for appraisal. So it's a very it's really strange. I think it's a really strange environment that we have in terms of appraisal, and I think that whole model needs revisiting in some way because I don't think it's working. I don't think that we're particularly motivated by it. I know that the performance related pay is being explored at the moment because if anything it's creating a lot of that fluff load, as you called it, Chris, instead of making significant differences for the children in our classrooms. I don't know if you agree or disagree.
Yeah, I've always found appraisals to be a slightly artificial process, or at least I think the more they're more artificial when there's certain targets that are set. As soon as people say, "Oh, okay, we want to set three targets across the year, one that relates to the school, one that equates to data, one that equate that relates, I should say, to your own personal development." I think the best appraisals I've had have been where I've been settled enough in the school and comfortable enough in the school for the head teacher to say, we're not going to bother with targets. I just want to check in with you. I just want to have a chat with how you're feeling about your teaching. What are you working on now?" But there's no pressure for that to be the same thing 6 months from now, which is what I always liked, because generally it isn't necessarily the case that what I'm going to be working on and what I want to improve on fits exactly with an academic year. Why should
Yeah.
it? It's the same with like math lessons.
Absolutely.
It's not necessarily the case that learning about equivalent fractions is going to fit perfectly into a 60-minute block, and nor should we necessarily squeeze it into that or stretch it out to that if that isn't it. We should be happy to kind of move on to the next bit of learning whenever is required. And I think it's the same with teacher professional development. So I think we end up with appraisals ending up sometimes going, trying to fit it into these termly blocks or academic year blocks. Of course, there's the other side of appraisals whereby for some teachers they are being used as you know, part of capability procedures and this sort of thing. So I understand why there might have to be something more formal in place. But if you're in a privileged situation where it can be that much more informal, where it is really more of a chat about what you're working on, what you're interested in, and how the school might be able to support you in that, it is, you know, it can be pretty productive.
Yeah, I do think that the whole, I was speaking to a friend who was a retired teacher. She'd been retired for probably 10 years and she still talked about terms. She said, like, after 40 years, like, that was her mentality. And I think that we're so structured, aren't we? We are so structured and almost institutionalized by schedules and times that we end up just meekly going, Victorians, 6 weeks. Tudors, 6 weeks, like everything fits these neat 6 week blocks, and appraisals must happen every year rather than, I like that idea of project based appraisals. You're going to work on this. We'll check in on you and see how that's going. So it's going back to people's strengths, isn't it? And saying, you've got a real strength here. Let's make this a project that's part of an ongoing process. Right. So, leading on to that, so I'd said about the improvements. So research by the Corporate Leadership Council, that sounds like a fun crew, doesn't it? Found that when managers focus on an employee's weaknesses, his or her performance declines by 27%. So that's where the 27% was. Whereas a focus on strengths boosts performance by 36%. Now, that's literally between a positive and a negative, and it's more than 50% difference. And that has the note of yes next to it. So I obviously like that bit. It's funny reading these back. Okay, so this is a great line. This is later on, and my note for this is true. It says, when people quit, in fact, they're not quitting their jobs, they're quitting their bosses. Managers account for at least 70% of the variance in employee engagement. So again, I think we're in that environment in education, which is very top down, and the concerns of what people above us are thinking drips down, and that becomes an unbearable weight for some, and some others pass that weight on. And I wonder whether some of the teachers who've left are sort of victims or casualties, if you like, of bosses who've had that burden of pressure put on them. And unfortunately, that has translated into pressure being put on the teachers, be it increased workload, be it physical pressure, demands to get to these grades or these targets set. But certainly, I think that phrase that people aren't quitting their jobs, they're quitting their bosses, I think that rings true for a lot of people that I've spoken to who have left. I mean, they call it toxic schools, and that's an environmental built thing, isn't it? And I think that they're not leaving teaching, they're leaving their experience of teaching within that environment.
Couldn't agree more with that one. I mean, that one really hits home. My partner, Sylvia, she's currently working in a school. And one thing she says about me, she talks about all the bits and pieces she doesn't like and what she does like, etc. But one of the things she says is, you know what, I like my department and my boss, get on with them. And I hear a lot of the same, you know, complaints about the school and things that she loves, lessons that have gone well. All of the things are basically the same, but the difference in her enjoyment of the job, how she feels about the job, seems so closely aligned with whether she respects the person who's her line manager as such, and whether that line manager respects her. And that aligns with my experiences as well. I mean, there's been, in the different roles I've had in schools and outside school, I've been fortunate at points to have some really, really good bosses and, dare I say, some pretty awful bosses. And while everything else in the classroom has often felt, you know, pretty much the same, my actual enjoyment of the job, how I felt about it, even when I've been working the same at points ridiculous hours, it's just felt completely different when the boss is someone I respect. You know, basically four brilliant, well, lots of brilliant women that I've worked under, and some pretty terrible men. I'm not sure if that's a pattern widely yes. across education. Widely across education,
almost certainly the case.
yeah. A shout out to some, some of the brilliant bosses I've had, including, dare I say, like the last couple that I've had. Chloe Wardle and Sarah Cottingham, who are just brilliant, brilliant people to work for. I would work for Ambition for free if I get to continue to work either under either of those two. Anyway, sorry about that.
Bit no,
of a,
no, I think
bit of a
I think
shout out to two wonderful people.
No, I think that's fantastic to hear. And I think about one school that I worked at, and I think about the bosses that I had, and he was the best head teacher, the best boss I could have worked for, and I'd have fallen on my sword for that man. And he could have phoned me at 3 in the morning and said, "We've got a problem." And he was devoted to children first, and it literally went children and their parents and staff, and you could see, and you could cut through him, and it would be children first, and every decision he made was children first. And because, I mean, if you're a teacher, that is going to be your value system as well, isn't it? You're not going to go Excel first, then children. And I think because your values align with that, I'd have fallen on my sword for him. As a result, my happiest period of time teaching at that school, because it was joyous, because everything was about making this experience special and significant and intrinsic to the children's livelihoods. And it was wonderful. And that was led by a brilliant boss. And I left there because of the classic career progression, and I sobbed my heart out when I left, because I thought, I'm leaving part of me, and wow, I mean, not many jobs give you that feeling, and not many bosses give you that feeling, and yet, in my mind, it was really simple. He was devoted to the children and the children's priorities and their needs. Not their needs more than their needs, I would say. I'll give you one more quote from this book, but I would recommend it, Rebel Talent. It's written really well, and it's just got, yes, here's a study, here's a paper, here's something we found out, just like scattered gold. Slightly longer one, so I'll do my nice reading voice. In one study, my colleagues and I asked over 750 employees from various organisations to think about their current job. Some were asked to write about an idea, project, or workspace that they felt they personally owned. The rest were asked to write about how they spend their days at work. After everyone answered a few other unrelated questions, we presented them with an opportunity to help the research team by participating in a 5-minute survey without extra pay. The people primed to feel a sense of ownership were more likely to say yes. And I think that if we feel, and this is, I suppose, it's a nice sort of finisher. If we feel that we make a difference in the school, we will make a difference in the school. Whereas if we feel that we are just a number or a teacher filling a space, then we don't feel that we have a particular role in that school. I think if we feel like we are part of that, and it's again goes back to retention, seems to be sort of a recurring theme in this particular episode. If we feel valued, we are going to give so much more. And I think that was a really nice little snippet of this work. This happens outside of education, where people are far more cold, I would say, potentially about their careers. I mean, we're incredibly, I mean, I don't know. This is one of the strange things about education. I don't know about outside of education, whether nurses get together at the weekend for nurse ed or some other conference and share the latest papers or spend time making podcasts. And they probably do, but we are a strange breed. And I think that to get a large corporate survey like that, declaring that if people feel they've got a sense of ownership at work rather than are they just a cog, they will make a significant difference. And sometimes it's worth hearing that as well, isn't it? That hearing that you make a difference and knowing that you make a difference. And sometimes, because like every single week is just slightly different from the last week, we can get caught in the treadmill of terms and weeks and days going past and forgetting that actually, looking back, we have made a big difference. And sometimes it's really nice for someone to say that and acknowledge that. It's really, and also how long it like takes 20 seconds, doesn't it, sometimes? And yet that's the thing that you take home with you, rather than, God, I've still got that marking to do. Yeah, that someone has said, thank you for your help this afternoon. Those children, I've never heard those children speak about that sort of event before, or something like that.
There's almost like a lovely thread or connection of threads run through all the different quotes and the different conversation or parts of conversation we've had tonight, in as much as here are the things we deserve to expect from our role. Here are the ways that it's been realized in one way or another. But it's potentially that reading outside of education that allows us to find out what we don't yet know. You know, because I'm certain that in the teacher gap, they talk about the influence of feeling valued over remuneration and that kind of thing. So there are definitely studies out there. And it's almost a case of, if we're going to be the leaders that we can be for other people, you know, who put them and their sort of desires, but also their strengths ahead of meaningless, to some extent, accountability measures. You know, we can be that leader if we read outside of education. And as teachers, certainly as new teachers, if the more we read, the more we can understand what the world could potentially be like. Because when you're that young, I certainly would just accept this is the way things are. I need to get on board. You know, I come in, had to learn the national curriculum, had to learn the Ofsted dance. And it was only after many, many years that I realized, well, maybe if I don't do that dance, I might actually be a better teacher. So I think it's wonderful the way everything we've discussed and the threads you've tied together almost speak to the way education could be. And you're almost saying, here's a way you can do this. And it's by reading widely, you know, and voraciously outside of our field. Because I think reading about education is important, but you've definitely demonstrated how important it is to read beyond the sort of city wall, so to speak.
Yeah, I agree. I think, yeah, I still maintain a healthy sense of optimism. And I think that's really important as well. Like, it's really funny when you see the teaching adverts and you're like, don't do it, don't do it. But actually, then you're really excited about teaching the suffragettes on a Monday morning. Like, it's a weird old job, isn't it? But something that's really exciting to do. And I think giving new teachers and existing teachers a sense of optimism that we you know, it can still change, things will evolve. And I think that by and large, people are starting to go, we're losing far more people than we're replacing. There's something that we could be doing. Here are some things that we could be doing. I mean, the Teach Tap survey results just are so indicative, aren't they? And what a really nice snapshot you get of this is how people are feeling. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. But I definitely think we're in an exciting phase of education because I think we're slightly more empowered now that we're, I think significantly the conversation has moved on to beyond Ofsted, and I think that's really, really important. And I think that more and more teachers are now, especially head teachers, are finding the courage to go, actually, these are our values. We're gonna nail these to our mast, and please judge us by these rather than the hoops that sometimes we've perceived to be necessary to get the Ofsted judgment. I mean, I think I've always been tempted to just offer out to anyone who wants to have a banner outside their school that I would pay that just said, 100% of our children say that they love coming to this school. Because that's what if I was driving past a school and looking for a school for my child, that would excite me far more than Ofsted rated us good in all areas. Like, I couldn't give two shiny because I know some schools who've got outstanding Ofsted inspections that also heartily fail their special needs children. I know schools that have got appalling Ofsted inspections that care so deeply for their children, but for some reason they're in the wrong postcode or their data hasn't matched up. And it's a broad brushstrokes. It's the difficulty is it's like TripAdvisor. Someone will put a review on TripAdvisor if they've had a good meal or a really bad meal, and there's no midpoint. Unfortunately, with Ofsted, you get one or the other, don't you? It's one review rather than an amalgamated view. A collection of reviews that over time, you know, evens out to 3.4, 4.4, whatever. Instead, it's just one of them. And the weird thing is, if it's a really good review, they don't visit again for another 10 years. Whereas if it's really bad, then they just watch them and they go, well, that wasn't right. Let's try this, find out what they want from us. And maybe just what they want from us. And maybe the big listen will discover that what they want from us is we want children to be independent learners, ambitious thinkers who are able to cogitate on current affairs and at the same time able to write down and explain things effectively across all areas. You know, something that is something that teachers can absolutely get behind, rather than, and they definitely need to have this form and they need to fill in these documents in order to pass. Because I think even Ofsted would go, it's not that. And despite trying really hard to push out the myth busting, there is still the fear. And you can't operate a happy school on fear, can you?
Basically, every school I've worked in at some point in my career has gone from while I've been there, and it's not because I've been there, I'm not making any claims along those levels, but has gone from one Ofsted grade to a better Ofsted grade or a couple of better Ofsted grades. And in at least a couple of those cases, looking back, I think, you know what, if I'd had kids, I would have been much happier with them when the school was as it was when it was officially RI than what it became afterwards. Now, that's not always the case. I'm not making the suggestion that, you know, RI schools are better than good schools or whatever. But when you're under the skin of a school, when you're actually in it for a while and you see what is put in place, what, you know, data manipulation, what focus brief, you know, short-term focus on results, whatever it might be, that school leaders sometimes do to take a school from RI to good. Sometimes when you see that, it makes you really question the extent to which we should really be placing too much value on these briefly formed judgments from the outside.
Heartily agree.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we had a choice of schools for the boys, and we had one outstanding and one recently good school. And from my experience, when you're trying to get, I mean, I don't mean to contradict you, Chris, but I find that the effort that's taken to get there needs to be constant, if that makes sense. Whereas, like you say, if you haven't been inspected in 12 years, you don't know what's going on in a school, if that makes sense. And so we chose the school that had recently got a good Ofsted because of our sense of only ever really working in schools that were RI and then became good, if that makes sense. Sorry, Chris. I feel like I've just gone with the complete opposite of what you've
No,
said, but
I
that's
don't
not my
think that
intention.
necessarily contradicts too much. I mean, really, the underlying point I was making was purely that, having seen, you know, school worked in schools that are at different grades, and then with hindsight looking back on them, I'm just not that convinced that the good grade or the good with elements of outstanding as it was a better school than the one that was RI. Thinking across everything that the pupils experienced, the quality of the teachers, the quality of the curriculum, etc. In at least one of those cases, it really just came down to the extent to which the head teacher was able to manage an inspection. And yeah, so
There's
I
a
just.
school in Brixton that I think it's Brixton. I read about in The Guardian recently that inspected the inspectors and had people watching the way that the inspections were forming judgments. And I thought that was absolutely genius. Like, if you are going to make something that's going to make such a significant difference on our intake, on our teacher staff morale, on the fact that the pupils feel valued or not, then we're going to take a serious an observation of the way that you're conducting this as you are conducting it itself. I will dig that out for show notes, but I thought that was a really interesting perspective. And yeah, I don't think we should get rid of Ofsted at all. I don't think that's the case. I just think that the manner and style and the requirements, I think it needs a good investigation, but I think absolutely we need some regulatory body. Otherwise, there are some head teachers who will do their own thing in a really dangerous, malevolent way, because they're on a huge ego trip, and you've got a huge amount of control that you can use and coerce. And I think that it does need to be regulated, but I just think it's the way it's done and the impact that it has on others that certainly needs investigation and exploration.
Yeah, and just to add there, I mean, I also fundamentally agree with your point there, Kieran, about it being there being some, you know, on the thinking about the what I've heard on the grapevine, what I've seen, teachers I know, I think there are some schools out there that are rated outstanding and have been for decade for you know for a decade or more, where you think, yeah, this is there's some worrying stuff going on there. They have and just because they haven't been inspected in so on so long. In your situation, I'm pretty sure I would have made the same decision, Kieran, for exactly those reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was focusing on the trees as opposed to the forest because, like what you said there, Stephen, it is a really exciting time because it feels like, and obviously our opinions are biased and stuff, and perhaps we're in a bubble. But like you said, head teachers have more agency. We have more agency over how we get involved in our professional development. You know, we've got teachers writing for other teachers in a way that I've never seen before. Whereas in the past, certainly at the start of my career, it was very much a case of here is the message, act upon this message. And sometimes that message was fantastic, but at other times it was just a bunch of people in a room not knowing what greater depth was, including the people who were trying to explain what greater depth was. And
It's
so, you know, there were chicken dinners back then, you
yeah.
know, the glory days of new labor.
I went to it's a few years ago. I went to my one of my children's secondary schools, and this is rated outstanding. And they just introduced this thing called flight path, and the parents' evening. I thought, wait, I'm not quite sure what the flight path is, what it, how it's formulated, how it works, what it means. So I asked, it had been rolled out in that September. So this is sort of October, November time. So I asked all the teachers. And I've always told my children, don't ever let them know that I'm a teacher. Please don't ever let them know. I said, can you explain what the flight path is, please? And they all gave a different answer. They all gave a different answer. And you're thinking, this is something you've put this on because you think this is what's wanted, or you haven't explained it clearly enough. And if all the teachers think it's something different, then what hope have we got as parents? What hope have the children got of understanding what their flight path is? It was completely confusing. And this was an outstanding, well, still is an outstanding school.
Yeah, I cringed as soon as I heard the word flight path and I know a little bit about secondary education. It's that whole, oh, they've arrived at this and so they're going to be this,
Yes,
which
yes.
is
Yeah.
a bizarre way to think about the realities of the way that young people develop.
I mean, it's a weird one that my daughter's got a flight path of I think it's, I'm going to use old school. I'm going to say she's on 9A. So her flight path, what they're saying is that she's going to get an A, the equivalent, which is 9. But because she got a B in the assessment, it's marked as red. And I'm thinking, that's still really good. Still better than her dad got. Like, let's give them credit, shall we? I think it's just, it's a very strange sort of framework, isn't it? I think we're still in a situation in primary where we've got this tension in Key Stage 1, where Key Stage 1 want to deliver good SATs results. But at the same time, if they deliver good SATs results, it puts pressure on those children and those grades for the next 4 years because they were previously exceeding children, and it immediately puts pressure on them. I think, yeah, sorry, I could go on forever. Just I think it's very strange, very
No,
strange.
well, it is. You know, I think if we think primary accountability is odd, secondary accountability can be really odd. A
Yeah.
little story I heard recently was of teachers saying that they, after year 10s had done their mock exams, and they'd basically had from their flight paths, they'd had expected what they were expected to get at that point, and teachers had to write down a comment for every pupil to explain. Well, in previous years, they had to write a comment to explain if a pupil had overachieved. Well, why do you think they'd overachieved? You know, what's gone well? Yada yada yada. If the pupil had underachieved by their at this point expected grade, they had to write a comment. And they decided that now they were going to also ask teachers to write a comment for why they think they'd kind of achieved their expected grade. And you had swathes of teachers going, "But that's just expected.
That's what
It's just
happened.
there isn't a reason for it. It just." Happened the way we thought it was going to happen. So yeah, a lot of bemused teachers having to come up with reasons for why things happened the way it was expected to. yeah, secondary schools are weird. We're well out of it, gents, at primary.
Indeed.
For all of you Kofi, Kofi, Kofufu, however you pronounce it, you damn lovely supporters. It's a song going out to you, to you. Septi, Stephanie Taylor, Mrs. B. Esatea, Adam, Katie, Lid, MC, Becca, Jenford, Susie, Brown, and Cio, Neccio, Rachel, I am out, Jessica, Tom Oakley, Tom Brassington, Jessica, Tom Oakley, Tom Brassington, LJ, and last but not least, my lovely little Amy Bills. Oh, they help us pay the bills. Oh, a massive thank you out to Dabbe family. Kofi supporters help us keeping it ad free. There's far more content coming just round the bend. Thank you all for helping our very special friends. Friends. Very special friends.
Fantastic. I mean, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you tonight, Stephen, and taking inspiration. You know, I'm certainly going to be trying to read it. I mean, I normally read history books when I'm doing my nonfiction reading, but I need to get back into sort of exploring different fields and stuff like that there. But on the horizon, you have edited, or certainly in the process of editing, a book yourself.
So in September, October time, Tom Bennett of Research Ed fame and ex-nightclub bouncer, which is always a good fact, asked me to edit the Research Ed Guide to Primary Literacy. I put some feelers out and I had in my mind a very clear journey that I wanted the book to take, because a lot of these are, someone will pick up the book and they'll choose the chapters they want to read, and I wanted one chapter to flow onto the next chapter, which is challenging when you've got a whole range of different reading styles. But I worked out the structurally the journey of how you build up primary literacy from my viewpoint, certainly. So we've got chapters on phonics, chapters on the way that writing is structured and stories are structured, a chapter on handwriting, chapter on oracy and the value of oracy, a chapter on the way that one school, this is Andrew Percival, has organised the weighting of literacy across his year groups. And that's actually fascinating, the way that they put a huge focus on certain areas at the start of juniors, shall we say, 3, 4, and then it slowly weights up in 5, 6. And it's I'd always thought, and it goes back to what we were saying, Chris, about the fact that everything needs to be divided up perfectly evenly and make sure it's fair. It's like a family cake, isn't it, that everyone has to have the right portion. And they've gone, well, that doesn't make sense. Let's put a huge amount of front-loaded effort into these areas so that we don't have to think about them in the later years, and we can focus on more important things. So, and that, I think that's the end of the book. So it starts with a project and ends with a project as well. So a lot of it draws on teacher experience as well, which is just as valuable, because we can hear all sorts of research and read all sorts of papers, but if we see something in a classroom that works and it just works, then we're more likely to try it because we've seen it with our own eyes. And I think that there's a huge value in that. So that's hopefully coming out May, June time, alongside a primary research head conference as well. So it'll be, you know, no biros, all glitter, very much primary. And that'd be probably in London. We've got two venues that we're looking at in London. So hopefully we'll be able to share more information about that shortly.
I mean, that's really exciting. You know, so obviously we love Research Ed and going to as many as we possibly can. And for there to be a primary focused one, I think that would be extra special because, you know, the more we can engage primary teachers in research informed practice and even just questioning things that are happening in schools and looking for sources of reliable information, I think it's massively important. So I'm looking forward to both of those.
I mean, it's the contact thing as much as anything. I can remember when I started teaching, you'd get these things that were called training days, and they were in school time, often in a nice hotel. You'd get excited about the fact that you could wear home clothes. You'd get a meal, often a hotel meal, and you'd get this feedback form at the end. And you'd, whatever the course, you'd always put what was the best thing, sharing good practice with colleagues. And you're thinking, like, these moments that you have when you're talking with other people who are not in your setting, going, yeah, me too, or how did you do that? And everyone is completely at ease. I think that a lot of these conferences and things that, like the BrewEd thing, is sitting next to someone else going, yeah, me too. That happens to me. Or how did you do it? Like those conversations, which have diluted because now it's a twilight over Zoom and no biscuits. I mean, the hotel industry must be devastated at the fact that teachers aren't coming anymore. I really miss those days, those training days, because they were, I'm sure they were really, really expensive for schools, but they were so valuable. You'd come back, you'd be on fire, wouldn't you? You'd be on fire for a week. We're just excited about things and have made contact with people. So, yeah, I think that the conference circuit that's really, really blossomed is really beneficial in terms of simply meeting other teachers as well in a yeah, I feel that way too, sort of environment.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, because, I mean, we had a four-hour drive back from Warrington last week or 2 weeks ago. Wasn't tired. We're just buzzing from all the conversations
yeah.
And stuff like that. So, you know, so. You can't put a price on that, really, I don't think. So watch this space, and hopefully we'll have some more time for conversations, perhaps on literacy, perhaps on the conference as well. All I have to do is say thank you very much for joining me. Thank you very much, Stephen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Thank you very much, Christopher.
Thanks for having me.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.